Section 17 of On the Nature of Things. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Anna Simon. On the Nature of Things by Lucretius. Translated by John Selby Watson. Section 17, Book 6, Part 2. Furthermore, it is easy to understand from these observations how those phenomena, which the Greeks from their nature have called presteres, sent down from above, descend into the sea. For it sometimes happens that they drop like a column let down from the sky into the ocean, around which column the waters boil, being excited by violent blasts of wind, and whatever vessels are then caught in that vortex are tossed about and incur the greatest danger. This occurs when, as is at times the case, the impetuous force of the wind is not able to burst a cloud of which it has taken possession, but bears it down, so that it becomes by degrees like a pillar reaching from the heaven into the sea, as if something were thrust down from above with a hand, and the force of an arm, and stretched into the waters. Hence, when the fury of the wind has burst the cloud, it rushes forth into the sea, and excites an extraordinary agitation among the waves, for the blast descends as a rolling whirlwind, and brings down with it the cloud which is of a yielding substance, and not easy to be disruptured, and when it has once thrust the heavy body of the cloud into the water of the ocean, it suddenly plunges itself wholly into the waves, and disturbs all the sea with a mighty noise, forcing it to boil with agitation. It happens also, at times, that a vortex of wind involves itself in clouds, gathering up cloudy atoms from the air, and imitates, as it were, a prester sent down from heaven. When this vortex has descended to the earth, and has burst, it vomits forth, and tempests abroad, the impetuous fury of a whirlwind. But such a vortex, because it is formed but seldom, and because the hills must obstruct its progress on the land, appears more commonly in the wide prospect and open atmosphere over the sea. Clouds are formed when many atoms of a rough and hooked nature, flying in the higher region of the heaven above us, have suddenly come together and combined, atoms which, though attached only in a slight degree, may yet be held united in a body. These first cause small clouds to gather. Those small clouds then unite, and are combined with one another, and as they join, swell and are carried along by the winds with such violence, that at length a raging tempest arises. It occurs, too, that the nearer to any part of the sky the elevated summits of the hills are, so much the more constantly do they smoke, as it were, with the thick mist of a yellow cloud, because when the clouds first gather, and before the eye can discern their thin substance, the winds, carrying them off, collect them on the highest tops of the hills. Here at last it happens that, when a larger collection is formed, one dense and solid cloud seems both to show itself and to rise at the same time from the summit of the hills into the clear sky. For the nature of the ground itself, and our own perceptions as we climb high mountains, demonstrate that breezy eminences are open to the ascent of exhalations. Besides, that nature raises many atoms of vapour from the whole surface of the ocean, garments suspended upon the shore testify, inasmuch as they contract and retain moisture. To augment the clouds, therefore, many atoms seem likely to arise from the motion of the salt water, for the nature and action of all waters is similar. Moreover, we observe mists and vapours arise from all rivers, and from the earth itself also, which, exhaled from it like a breath, are in the same manner carried upwards, and cover the sky with obscurity, and, uniting together by degrees, form clouds high in the air. For the influence of the starry heaven above, too, keeps down the vapours, and, condensing them, weaves the blue sky over, as it were, with clouds. It is possible, likewise, that to this assemblage of clouds may come seminal atoms from without the heaven, which may assist to form mists and flying storms. For I have shown that the number of primordial atoms is countless, and that the extent of the depth of space is infinite. And I have demonstrated, too, with how great celerity seminal particles fly, and how instantaneously they have power to pass through an inexpressible distance. It is not, therefore, wonderful if storms and darkness, diffused from above, cover in a short time such vast mountains as well as the whole sea and land, since on every side exits and entrances are allowed to the elemental atoms through all the passages of the air, and, as it were, through all the breathing places of the vast universe around. Attend now, and I will explain how rain collects in the clouds above, and how the showers are precipitated and descend upon the earth. In the first place I shall observe that many atoms of moisture arise, together with the clouds themselves, from all things on the earth, and that both these substances, the clouds and the water which is contained in the clouds, increase together in the same manner as our body grows together with the blood that is in it, and as sweat and other moisture, which are diffused throughout the limbs, are augmented together with them. The clouds, too, when the wind drives them over the wide sea, frequently attract much moisture from the salt water, like fleeces of wool suspended in the air. In like manner, moisture is raised from all rivers into the clouds, where, when numerous particles of water have in many ways collected, and have been augmented from every quarter, the swollen clouds strive for two reasons to discharge themselves, for the force of the wind presses them, and the mass of clouds itself, when a greater body than ordinary has united, urges and weighs them down from above, and makes the rain flow forth upon the earth. Moreover, when the clouds are rarefied by the wind, or when they are dissolved by the influence of the sun's heat from above, they forthwith discharge rain, their moisture distilling as wax, thoroughly melted, drops over a strong fire. But violent rain takes place when the clouds are vehemently urged by both forces, being densely heaped upon one another, and pressed by the impetuosity of the wind. And rains are accustomed to last long, and to continue for a considerable period, when many particles of moisture flow together, and when there are clouds on clouds heaped one over another, pouring down water from above, and from every part around, and when the whole earth, fuming with vapour, sends back moisture into the air. Then, when the sun, in the midst of a dark storm, and when the rain descends opposite to him, has shone upon the shower with his rays, the hues of the rainbow appear upon the black clouds. Other matters, which gather above us, and are produced above us, and all bodies, all I say, without exception, which collect in the clouds, as snow, wind, hail, and cold frost, as well as the strong power of ice, the great hardener of the waters, and the restraint which everywhere delays the eager rivers, all these, though numerous, it is yet very easy to understand, and to comprehend how they are produced, and from what cause they arise, when you have thoroughly learned what virtues and qualities belong to the atoms which constitute their substance. Give me now your attention further, and learn what is the cause of earthquakes. And first, suppose the earth to be below, as it is above, filled in every part with airy caverns, and containing also, in its bosom, many lakes and many pools, as well as stones and fissured rocks, while you must likewise suppose that it rolls along forcibly, beneath the surface of the soil, many hidden rivers, floods, and submerged rocks, for nature herself requires that the earth be similar to itself throughout. These points, then, being laid down and admitted, the earth quakes on the surface when it is shaken by great falls of substances beneath, as when age brings down vast caverns, for then whole mountains sink, and, from the violent shock, tremblings spread far and wide in a moment, an effect which we may naturally imagine, since whole houses totter by the side of a road when shaken with wagons, though of no great weight, nor are edifices less agitated when the stout drivers of chariots hurry along the street the iron rounds of the wheels. It happens also that when a large mass of earth rolls down, from the effects of time, into a wide and deep pool of water, the water is agitated, and the earth, too, trembles with the concussion of the flood, as a vessel of liquid cannot stand still upon the ground unless the liquid, after being shaken, has ceased to sway with a rocking motion within it. Moreover, when wind, collected in the hollow places under the earth, bears strongly from one quarter, and, struggling with vast power, crowds into the deep caverns, the earth, towards the part where the force of the blast directs itself, inclines and gives way, and then the buildings which are erected upon the earth's surface, sloping and being driven from the perpendicular, lean in the same direction, and so much the more as they respectively rise higher into the air, while the beams, being stretched, stand out as ready to start from their places. And do men hesitate to believe that a time of ruin and destruction awaits the whole fabric of the world, when they see so vast a mass of the earth give way? Whereas even now, unless the winds were to remit their fury, no power could save all things, or could hinder them from going to destruction. But because they relax and struggle by turns, and, as if collecting their force, return to the charge, and then retreat as if repulsed, the earth, on this account, oftener threatens ruin than actually suffers it, for it inclines and starts back, as it were, only for a time, and then, making an effort with its whole weight, recovers its station. From this cause, accordingly, all our houses tremble and reel, the highest more than the middling more than the lowest scarcely at all. There is also this cause of great quaking of the earth to be mentioned. When wind, and any vast quantity of air, collected either without or within the earth, has suddenly thrown itself into hollow places under the ground, it there rages at first with violent fury among the vast caverns, and rolls and urges itself along. But at length, when its force is roused and excited, it bursts forth abroad, and, cleaving the deep soil, forms a huge yawning chasm, as happened in Syrian Sidon, and was seen at Egym in the Peloponnesus, which cities, such an eruption of air and an earthquake produced at the same time, overthrew and destroyed. Many other cities also, by reason of violent earthquakes, have sunk down to the ground, and many cities, with their inhabitants, have been overwhelmed in the sea. But if the force of the air and violent fury of the wind do not burst through the soil, they yet spread like shuddering blasts through the numerous openings in the ground, and thus cause a tremor on the surface, as cold, when it penetrates into our limbs, shakes them, and compels them to tremble and quiver against our will. Men, therefore, in cities, are appalled on such occasions with double terror, for they dread the buildings above them, and are afraid at the same time lest the earth should suddenly break up the depths below, and lest, being disruptured and disordered, it should open wide its jaws and prepare to fill them with its own ruins. Though men, therefore, think that the heavens and the earth will be imperishable and are entrusted to eternal safety, yet, at times, the present influence of danger causes in some degree the sensation of fear. A fear lest the earth, suddenly withdrawn from beneath their feet, should sink down into a gulf, and lest the sum of things, utterly overthrown, should follow it, and only a confused wreck of the world remain. I must now proceed to give a reason why the sea knows no augmentation. In the first place, men wonder that nature does not necessarily enlarge the ocean, into which there is so great a conflux of waters, and into which the rivers run from all quarters. But add to the rivers, if you please, the wandering showers and flying storms, which scatter and discharge themselves over all the sea and the earth. Add, if you please, the sources of the rivers. Yet all these, compared with the vastness of the sea, are but as one drop of water for the augmentation of the whole. It is no wonder, therefore, that the mighty ocean is not increased. Besides, the sun, by the influence of his heat, draws a large portion away from it. For we observe how the sun dries with his burning rays garments that are drenched with moisture. But the ocean, we see, is large and widely extended beneath his beams, And although, therefore, the sun may exhale but a small portion of the moisture from each spot on the sea, it will yet deduct a large quantity from its waters throughout so great an extent of surface. Moreover, the winds, I say, which sweep the ocean, may carry off a considerable portion of its liquid, for we often see the roads, after being drenched with rain, dried in a single night, and a crust of mud, which before was soft, hardened and congealed upon them. The clouds, too, I have before shown, take up a large quantity of moisture, which is attracted by them from the vast surface of the ocean, and which they sprinkle, in various parts, over the whole round of the earth, at times when rain falls on the ground, and when the winds drive the clouds athwart the sky. Lastly, since the earth is of a porous consistence, and is in contact with the sea, encompassing the shores of the deep on all sides, the water, as it flows from the earth into the sea, must likewise pass, reciprocally, from the salt sea into the earth, for the salt is strained off, and the pure substance of the water flows back into the ground, and collects altogether at the sources of rivers, from whence it returns in fresh streams over the earth, wherever a passage once cut has conveyed the flood in its liquid course. I shall now explain what is the cause that fires at times burst forth with such tempestuous fury from the jaws of Mount Etna. For it was not from any divine origin of calamity that a storm of fire, rising and raging over the fields of the Sicilians, attracted to itself the attention of the neighboring nations, when, observing all the regions of heaven covered with smoke and gleaming with flames, they felt their breasts filled with awful anxiety, dreading what new catastrophe nature might design to produce. In contemplating such subjects as these, you must stretch your view widely and deeply, and look far abroad in all directions, that you may remind yourself that the sum of things is vast, and reflect how very small, how infinitely small a part of the whole universe is this one haven, not even so considerable a part as one man is of the whole earth. This point, if you fully consider and fully understand, when it is fairly presented to your mind, you may forbear to wonder at many things which now excite your admiration. For in respect to our own bodies, which of us is surprised if any of his neighbours has contracted a fever that spreads through his frame with a burning heat, or has felt any other painful disease in his limbs? Since the foot often swells on a sudden, a sharp pang frequently seizes the teeth, or darts through the eyes, erysipelas arises, and creeping through the frame, burns whatever part it has attacked, and spreads itself over the limbs. Nor is it strange that such maladies should occur, for there are atoms ready to produce many effects, and this earth and air contain seeds enough of noxious disease, from which an abundance of infinite disorder may have its growth. Thus, too, we must suppose that, as to our own bodies, so to the whole heaven and earth are plentifully supplied all kinds of atoms from the immensity of matter, by the effects of which the earth, being suddenly moved, may quake with agitation, while a rapid hurricane may rush over sea and land, the fire of Etna may swell forth, and the heaven be in a blaze. For even this happens, even the celestial regions glow with heat. Thus, too, storms of rain arise with a greater combination of force when particles of moisture have in like manner chanced to unite themselves. But the raging fire of Etna, you will say, is extraordinarily great. Doubtless, I answer, and a river, which has been seen by any person, appears extraordinarily great to him who has never before seen a greater. And a man, or a tree, possibly appears large to the eyes of some animals, and every one imagines everything of every sort, which is the greatest that he has seen, to be extremely large, although all things that he beholds, together with the heaven and the earth and the ocean, are as nothing in comparison with the entire sum of the entire whole. I will now, however, explain by what causes the fire of Etna, when suddenly excited, bursts forth from its vast furnaces. In the first place, the fabric of the mountain is hollow underneath, supported for the most part by arches of flintstone. In all the caverns, moreover, is wind and air, for air, when it is moved by any agitating impulse, becomes wind. When this air, then, has grown hot, and has heated all the rocks and earth round about, as far as it reaches, and elicited from them fire raging with violent flames, it mounts up, and thus expels the blaze straight from the jaws of the mountain, high into the air, and spreads it far abroad, and scatters the embers to a great distance, and rolls forth smoke heavy with thick darkness, while it darts out, at the same time, rocks of a wonderful weight. You cannot, therefore, doubt but that it is the violent force of air which produces these effects. Besides, the sea, for a considerable distance, alternately breaks its waves and again retracts its tide at the base of that mountain. From this sea caverns extend underground as far as the ascending jaws of the mountain. By these caverns you must admit, for fact absolutely compels you, that blasts of wind enter and penetrate from the open sea, and thus exalt the flame, and cast up rocks, and raise clouds of sand. For on the summit of the mountains are craters, as the Greek call them, but which we call jaws and mouths. There are some phenomena, too, for which it is not sufficient to assign merely one cause, but it is requisite to enumerate many, of which, however, only one can be the true cause. As if, for example, you should see the dead body of a man lying on the ground at a distance, you naturally run over all the probable causes of his death, that the one cause of it may be sure to be mentioned. For neither, perhaps, can you prove that he died by the sword, nor of the effects of cold, nor by disease, nor by poison, but we know that it is something of this destructive nature that has happened to him. This same observation we may make in respect to many other things. The Nile, the river of all Egypt, is the only one of all streams in the world that swells towards summer and inundates the fields. This river waters Egypt from time to time during the middle of the hot season, and this happens, possibly, because the north winds, which are said to be Etesian winds, prevail at that time in the summer over against the mouth of the river, and, blowing up the stream, retard it, and thus, forcing the flood up the channel, fill it, and compel the waters to stagnate. For without doubt these breezes, which come from the cold stars of the North Pole, advance against the stream. The river flows from the warm countries, taking its rise from the extreme south, and from the regions of noonday amidst the races of mankind blackened with scorching heat. It is possible also that a great collection of sand, at times when the sea, excited by the wind, drives the sand within the bed of the river, may cause obstruction at the mouth of the stream to the waters coming towards it. By this means it may happen that the outlet of the river may be less free, and that the current of the water likewise may be rendered less impetuous. It is also possible, perhaps, that rain may fall more abundantly near its source, at the very time when the Etesian winds from the north drive all the clouds into those parts. For when the clouds, impelled towards the regions of the south, have collected there in a body, they are at last pressed and driven against the lofty mountains, and compelled by the force of the wind to discharge their waters. Perhaps, too, it may have its increase entirely from the high hills of the Ethiopians, at the time when the sun, shining on all parts of them, forces the white snow, with its dissolving rays, to descend in a flood upon the plains. Give me now your attention, and I will show with what nature and qualities the regions and lakes which are called Avernian are distinguished. In the first place, as to the circumstance that they are named Avernian, that name has been given them from their peculiar property, inasmuch as they are destructive to all kinds of birds, and because when any of the feathered tribe have, in their flight, come over against those parts, forgetful of their steerage, they relax the sails of their pinions, and, sinking down with powerless neck, fall headlong on the ground, if, perchance, the nature of the parts beneath allow them to fall thus, or into the water, if a lake of Avernus happen to be stretched under them. Such a spot is near Cumae, where the hills smoke from being charged with vivid sulphur, and abounding with hot springs. There is also a place within the walls of Athens, on the very summit of the hill, close by the temple of bountiful Tritonian Pallas, to which the hoarse crows never direct their flight, not even when the altars smoke with offerings. So carefully do they avoid, not the violent wrath of Pallas on account of watchfulness, as the poets of the Greek have sung, but the fumes of the sulphur, for the nature of the place produces this effect of itself. There is also reported to be a place in Syria, plainly to be seen, to which, as soon as four-footed animals have directed their steps, the very nature of it causes them to fall heavily on the earth, as if they were suddenly made a sacrifice to the infernal deities. But all these things are affected by the operation of nature, and the origin of them, and from what causes they arise, is apparent, so that the gate of Tartarus must not be thought to be situate in these regions, nor, moreover, must we imagine that the infernal deities can possibly draw souls down from hence into the coasts of Acheron, as swift stags, with the breath of their nostrils, are often supposed to draw the crawling tribes of serpents from their hiding places. But observe, I pray you, how far all this is at variance with just reasoning, for I now proceed to give you a full explanation concerning this very subject. In the first place, I assert this, which I have also frequently asserted before, that there are in the earth all kinds of forms of the atoms of things, of which there are many that are wholesome for food, and many that may bring on disease and hasten death. We have also previously shown that for different animals, with regard to the substance of life, some substances are better adapted than others, on account of their dissimilar natures, and opposite constitution one to the other, and the primary figures of their seminal particles. Many noxious atoms pass through the ears, many that are offensive and harsh to the sense penetrate through the nostrils, nor are there few only which are to be avoided by the touch, or shunned by the sight, or which are bitter to the taste. You may notice, too, how many things are of a violently pernicious influence on mankind, both disagreeable and deadly. To certain trees, we may first observe, has been assigned a poisonous shade, so that they often cause pains in the head if anyone lies stretched on the grass beneath them. There is likewise on the high mountains of Helicon a tree which has been known to kill a man by the malignant odour of its blossom. All these destructive substances, you will understand, spring from the ground, because the earth contains many seeds of many things mingled in many ways, and distributes them separately to different productions. And when a night taper, just extinguished, strikes a person's nostrils with a pungent odour, it takes away his senses, so that he falls down on the very spot, as when that disease takes effect which is accustomed to stretch men at full length. And a woman, overcome with the strong scent of castor, if she has smelled it at the time at which she discharges her menses, falls backward, and her elegant work drops from her tender hands. And many other things relax the organs, causing them to languish throughout the body, and disturb the soul in its seat within. Besides, if, with a stomach too full, you even stay long in a warm bath, or are drenched in a layer of tepid water, how easily may it often happen that you may fall down fainting in the middle of it? And how easily does the oppressive vapour and scent of charcoal find an entrance into the brain, unless we have first taken a draught of water? But when it has penetrated through all the well-warmed apartments of a house, the odour of wine then falls like a deadly blow upon the nerves. Do you not observe also that sulphur is produced in the earth itself, and that bitumen, with its offensive smell, forms concretions in it? When, moreover, men seek for veins of silver and gold, searching the hidden depths of the earth with iron instruments, how strong an odour does the mine exhale from beneath? Or have you not learned how much poison is in the earth for gold mines to exhale? What sort of looks and complexions do they produce in the men who work in them? Do you not remark, or hear from others, in how short a time they are wont to waste away, and how length of life is necessarily withheld from those whom superior power confines in such an employment? The earth, evidently, steams forth all these vapours, and breathes them out into the regions of the air which are open and ready to receive them. So, likewise, the regions of Avernus must send up from beneath a vapour destructive to birds, a vapour which ascends from the earth into the air, in such abundance as to poison the body of the atmosphere to a certain extent. So that, as soon as a bird has been borne thither on its wings, it is there stopped, being so violently affected by the invisible poison, that it drops down over against the spot where the exhalation raises itself. And when the bird has fallen there, the same force of the exhalation takes away the remains of life from all its members. For at first it only excites, as it were, a certain giddiness in the birds, but afterwards, when they have fallen from on high on the very sources of the poison, it comes to pass that they must there yield up even their life, because a vast quantity of the poisonous exhalation surrounds them. It happens also at times that this vapour and exhalation of Avernus disperses the air which intervenes between the birds and the earth, so that that portion of the atmosphere is left from this cause almost empty, and when the birds in their flight have come over against this part, the effort of their wings immediately halts and grows ineffectual, and every struggle of their pinions on either side is unsupported. Thus, when they are unable to flap their wings or to rest upon them, nature, you will understand, compels them to descend to the earth by their own weight, and accordingly, sinking down through the part which is almost a vacuum, they disperse abroad their lives through every pore of the body. End of section 17.